welcome and thank you for being here. So most of you know about it. I mean, actually, no, not most of you, because some I haven't seen already. So I'm actually Adrien Rigobello. So I'm the manager of the Makerspace here in École des Ponts and academic coordinator of the Advanced Master Design by Data. So basically, with the as a context, like for the Makerspace, what we are trying to do is to foster a community around fabrication, be it digital, with laser cutting, 3D printing, and so on. And like, but also within the space, the design space, to say other kind of material rather than just PLA or wood or cardboard, things like this. Some of you might know that we have a bronze casting facility, so this kind of stuff. So in this regard, the idea of the Makerspace is to foster interdisciplinary design, let's say. So between all of you here, you see that you have different specialty. And here we have some guys that are doing research. We have some guys that are doing advanced master, initial trainings, first year, and so on. So the idea is to learn from all these different practices. So we also have people from the administration of École des Ponts that are coming sometimes, and architecture students. So the idea of this Makerspace is to actually activate this community. So in order to do that, we are organizing this series of conferences, of lectures, and starting with Grace today, in order to inspire and like have triggers to discuss about some, fabrication-based topics. But as you will see, I chose to broaden a bit the scope of just fabrication, and to have so Grace, that is a designer, maker, and artist, to come in order to show you, more like material-aware design in more creative ways, rather than just what we can see here. And I tend to believe that what she is going to present is inspiring, but also advocating somehow for crossing path between disciplines and showing that even if she has a training in design and arts, she's very much aware and she's very curious about engineering and science at large, like physics, at large. And that's feeding her work. And I hope that this encourages you also to work with other kind of disciplines and so on, and eventually come to the Makerspace and make stuff. That's the whole point of it. So, yeah, without further ado, I think it's time for you, Grace, to come present us your works.
Thank you. Thank you for the lovely introduction. Okay, maybe should we experiment a little bit with the lights? So thank you all for coming. My name is Grace. I'm a designer, maker, researcher, as Adrian mentioned. My practice started a little bit with 3D design, so with Caesar over there. We were doing kind of like crafts-oriented university, which started with a lot of making and a lot of understanding of traditional properties and traditional techniques for making. Then continued on with a more human-centered, interaction-based course in RCA called Information Experience Design. Hopefully this presentation is gonna give you a little bit of an insight into what sort of things I've been interested in, maybe inspire you guys too, and maybe we have some interesting conversations. So I've been prepared that you guys are quite intense with your questions. I came prepared to answer all of the difficult questions. So thank you for coming. So I thought to start a little bit with some interaction. So question, what does this tell you? Like by studying this object, by seeing this object, what can you tell about how it looked like originally? Or the colors are not very clear, but can you guess what sort of material that was? Okay, so it was actually not plaster, but so if you see here, it's not very clear the colors, but there's some green residue. Exactly. So yeah, like I've been fascinated into archaeology and into looking into how materials age and how materials are collecting all of those stories and how they're captures of those like past presences. So another little exercise. What can this tell you about the materials and how it, like the story of how it used to look? So basically what is happening here is the sculpture used to have stone eyes, but then the thing is that stone and metal have different expansion rates. So even though they were attached in the beginning, during the life of the object, the like one expanded in a different rate from the other, so they eventually detached from going through the cold and hot and cold and hot, and like they popped, and we were just remained with a bigger object, and then the smaller got lost in the process. And then another little interesting detail that I found very fascinating, like if we pay attention a little bit to the hair of the horse and the hair of the human. So the thing is, even though the two pieces fit perfectly together, we see from the detailing of the hair that it was made by two different people. So it's kind of like this story of like, okay, maybe it's not, they do fit together, but it was clearly someone else that did this than this. Then there's an indication of a studio, like of people coming together in a workshop to make stuff. And I really like kind of like how you can reverse engineer these stories and understand about materials. And then going a little bit further into stuff, like this one is from the Antikythera mechanism shipwreck. Do you guys know about the Antikythera mechanism? So the Antikythera mechanism, it's a system of cogs. It's supposedly the first computer, the first analog computer. So it's an analog calculator that was calculating positions of the stars and the moon and the constellations, and then people would use it as a navigation tool. But then it was lost in this shipwreck for ages, and then alongside some other artifacts. And one of the artifacts that was in this was the sculpture. So in this case, we have the big horse that the head broke off. The head was exposed to corrosion, and then what happened is the body, it landed in the sand. So the top side of the body was protected by the sand, and then the rest was exposed to corrosion. So now, like, if you go close to it, the top part, it still has marks from the mark making, from the like from the making of the actual sculpture, from the creation of the sculpture. But then the rest has exposure to this corrosion. And then because we had all of these big sculptures in that site, then we were able to, like, there was a call for all of this archaeological research. And then during that research, the calculator was also found, but then otherwise we would never found it. Looking into these stories of how things come and go, like this has a very interesting story in terms of materials that come and go. So this was found in a volcanic site. So it was in Santorini, where there was this big explosion, and a lot of volcanic ash covered all of the houses. And the thing is, wood, it doesn't sustain time so much. So like, we don't have a lot of examples of ancient craftsmanship. But then in this case, what happened is the volcanic ash went and covered all of the site, including some of the furniture. And then the wood corroded, as wood corrodes in like so many thousand years. And but then the dust stayed there as a capture of that shape. So like the wood corroded, but then the dust kept the story. So when the archaeologists found the site, they found a cavity inside the dust. So they poured plaster inside, and then they got the casting of a bed. So even though the object is not there anymore, we have this material process and progress that is being passed on to us. So it's much like the lost wax technique. I don't know if you guys know about it, but you should go to the makerspace and learn how to do otherwise. sorry, I'm gonna try not to cringe you guys too much. So going a little bit more into my actual making practice, it sprung with this object. So 12 years ago, I guess, unfortunately my grandmother passed away, and after her passing we went to her house to clear her house of her belongings, and then in her bathroom I found this cream, and I opened the cream, and on the surface of the cream there were marks of her fingers on the cream, like she had used it, so it was like had the marks, obviously. I don't know, I was really moved that even though my grandmother was not there anymore, that I had this like daily object that just had her presence somehow captured. So then I kept it, and I have it on my desk for ages. And one day my mom came in the house. She didn't know what it was. I just had quietly kept it and like didn't really mention it to anyone. And then while I was studying, she came there, she picked up the box, she opened it, she used some of the cream. I was like, oh my God, like that was my grandmother's prints. But then I paused a little bit and realized that I also had my mom's hands on the cream. And then there was this like layering of the stories and this continuation of the stories. And I don't know, I really liked that. So being a maker, I just want to explore this process through making and kind of like sorry, I'm losing a little bit my train of thought, but being a maker, I appreciate a lot materials and a lot how by holding objects and by touching objects and by creating objects and thinking with your hands, we're able to kind of connect with the knowledge that the objects are carrying, and also kind of connect with the potential that's impregnated within all of these artifacts. That's it, I guess. So a lot of making, a lot of time kind of reading how things work and understanding how like the umbrella mechanism works, or how scales work, or how levers work, and then going in the workshop and replicating all of these things and trying to connect with the knowledge in a very hands-on way, and then through that kind of trying to let the medium speak a bit and not be too prescriptive about it. And then it also means that I spend a lot of time carrying all of these things. There's also a little bit of social anthropology background, which it was very minimum, but it was also like kind of evident that I was leaning more towards the creative side of stuff and not so much in the research. But basically what it meant was that gave me confidence to approach more human-centered research and do some work with blind people and do some work with hospitals and doing some human-centered research and like spending a lot of time observing behavior and not just assuming behavior, but like putting the object in the context and seeing how it is actually going to behave. And then also the collaboration with Tomás Aracino. With the collaboration with Tomas Aresino, it's more on the design engineering side of stuff. So not so much in what I've been talking about so far, but it's more like in the problem solving like spectrum. So a lot of making, a lot of creation, and a lot of like putting experiments on air and sending sculptures in the sky. Just a little bit of context. So do you guys know of Tomas Aresino's work? So he did the exhibition now that just finished in Paletto Kyo called On Air. And it had a series of stuff. There was some stuff about spiders, some stuff about balloons, and then like that's a project where I'm involved in, which is solar sculptures. So big envelopes of air. So all of this is like just fabric filled with just atmospheric air. So we just take the sculpture and run against the air current and fill it with air, and then put it under the sun, and then the sun warms the air inside the sculpture, and they fly. And they fly up to 16 kilometers high without using any fossil fuels or hydrogen or electricity. And then you can do a lot of fun stuff with that, so like that's where I come in and kind of do some experiments. But yeah, all of this exploration is kind of replicating in a funny way. I was really skeptical about this slide. I'm not sure if it's going to make sense, but kind of how exploration, it starts from one point and you go and explore out, and then you pick up the things that you want to do, and then you go and reinforce that. So basically, yellow slime mold, it has this pattern of behavior that starts from one point, then expands to all directions, finds the ways that are more useful for it, so these two, goes back, reinforces, and then expand again. So like point, expand, decide, go back, reinforce, and then continue. So like it's kind of like also approaching how I approach my studies and how I approach the work, just like a lot of experimentation, a lot of testing. Like in RCA, in 2 years, I did something like 25 projects. And then from those, like starting to see some patterns and starting to reinforce some of those. So yeah, going through the 25 or so projects in RCA, there started to be this common thread, which was had a lot to do with materialization of the immaterial stuff. So treating light as a material. So in this case, it was just a lens behind the screen, and then the room was becoming like a black box, and then the light would shed through the lens and focus on the paper. I don't know if you've guys seen it happening, but it's basically what's happening in our cameras all the time. And then also looking at digital as a material, this was a collaboration that we did with the V&A Museum, where we digitalized 3D scans of hands. Then in that case, also the interaction became a material, and how do you reinforce that point of contact with the museum? And people are coming in the museum, and like you have this ritual, even though it was about digitalizing the hands of the visitors, very much focused, so was put in this point of contact, in this point of interaction. And then pressure as a material, or air as a material, archaeology and time as a material. And then going back to the anti-K-Terra mechanism. So in the case of the anti-K-Terra mechanism, the object is becoming a concentration of knowledge. So this object was created through series of developments, so people came together, some people knew how to forge the metal, some people knew how to create the cogs, some people knew how to how the universe functioned and how everything came together. And then they put this cog together, this calculator together, that became a concentration of that knowledge. Yeah, in a funny way, like there was this reading about vibrant matter, that that said that humans, they're a concentration of minerals that think and speak, but also maybe humans are a concentration of knowledge. So in the case of the Antikythera mechanism, it concentrated a lot of the knowledge of all of those people, but then afterwards it was hidden under the sea for ages. And so the shipwreck was several years before Christ, like 100 BC, I think. And during that time, it's important to think that even though the so people came together and they created the Antikythera mechanism. So the scientists developed all of the technology, and they were able to understand how things worked in a level that they knew of Kepler's laws, even though Kepler obviously wasn't alive yet. I don't know if this makes sense, but basically, yeah, like the science was very developed. But then this thing stayed under the sea. And then on the ground, if we think about history and how knowledge went on the ground during times of history, a lot of familiar faces, that's nice. So in the case of the Antikythera mechanism, the scientists had reached in a level where they knew of Kepler's laws, even though Kepler was not alive yet, and then all of this knowledge, it just stayed in a crust under the seabed. But then on the ground level, humanity went from knowing all of those stuff back to thinking that the earth is flat. So like if we think of Middle Ages and Dark Ages, where people thought that if you go on a boat and you go on the edge of the earth, you're gonna fall off. So, but then at the same time, while that was all happening, there was this calculator, like material presence of this thing under the sea that proves that we knew elsewhere, that we knew otherwise. So it's this kind of idea in my head that there's these kind of black box technologies and these like loss of knowledge, and like we're kind of creating all of these things, and then they're staying somewhere, and then we're not able to connect with them, and we're losing that knowledge. And maybe is that something that's happening now? Like, is it something that we're forget, even though like we're using a lot of things and a lot of objects are between us? Like, do we really understand how they work and how they function? So like in the case of the museums, we have all of these artifacts, but we don't touch them. We don't really interact with them. They're just captured inside a glass vitrine. And then like also with our technologies now, like, I don't know, if you guys know, like, I was thinking about this case that, so for example, do you know how the screen detects when you rotate it on the side? So basically there's a sensor inside that reacts when you twist the screen. Do you know how that works? Okay. Okay, so basically, I'm not sure if it's one of those three, but the one that I'm referring to is so there's this little sensor that is composed of two metal combs that are held together. So in horizontal form, they're like this. I'm not sure. Sorry, the microphone is probably not gonna take the best out of me for now. But yeah, so you have the two metal combs that are like this, and then there's weight on each side. And then when you twist the phone on the side, the two metal combs fall apart, and that's sending a signal that the phone is on the side. So it's kind of like, even though it is electrical, it is coming down to material properties, which we're not connecting to. So it's kind of like all kind of analog, not everything, of course, but like, it is coming down to material properties that we're not connecting to because they're inside these black box technologies. So what if we broke that open and we start to connect with these, and maybe that could help us pass on the knowledge and not get back to a second phase of humanity thinking that the earth is flat again? I don't know. So yeah, like I focused a little bit more in the case of the museums. So in the case of the museums, I was feeling like even though you're walking into an interior space, it's not really an interior, it's more like an inside out vitrine. So you're still going inside, like, but you're not really interacting with the artifact, you're not really interacting with the museum space, you don't, it's just like an inside out external space, so like an inside out vitrine. So it's feeling a lot like this. And okay, you still want to protect the artifact and you still don't want to touch it, but what if we broke the floor a little bit and broke the wall a little bit and allowed for some energy to flow through, like some interaction to happen between the person and the artifact? Then looking into different technologies of how, like different design problems and design like solutions into how people are designing for the future and designing for communication and designing for like reverse engineering. So this is a Long Now clock. Does anyone know of the Long Now Foundation? Okay, so this clock, I mean, this is a prototype of a clock. It's not the actual clock, but it is a prototype of a clock that is supposed to run for 10,000 years. So I don't know if it's easy to think about the scale of stuff, but 10,000 years ago, we didn't have civilization. It was like the beginning of our civilization. So imagine what's going to happen in 10,000 years from now. It's like kind of hard to think about like how our knowledge is going to propagate into the future and how, like, if it's going to be linear, or, like, if we're going to be able to communicate with people, like, if someone stayed alive from now until then, if he's going to be able to communicate in any way with the context. So it became a very interesting design challenge of, like, how do you design an object so that it can also become a carrier of that knowledge? So basically what's happening is they created this big clock where all of the cogs are open and then all of the weights that are directing it, so like it's the force coming from gravity, they're all open in this box so that people, if they find it in the process of it, they're able to, even if all engineering is disappeared and all knowledge is forgotten, that the object can teach them how to do it. So it's like this intuitive artifact. Does this make sense? Okay, cool. So yeah, like that is first to teach people in the future how to do engineering, I guess, and also how to repair it and fix it and help it propagate till it reaches the 10,000 years. And then also spent a lot of time looking into interactions with the museums. So a little bit of context. So this guy here, he was working for Volkswagen Future of Mobility, and then this girl here, she's a friend of mine from RCA, both known to be very smart people. And then you have this interaction inside the museum, which is like what you see when you think about design interactions. And they were trying for like 20 minutes, and they weren't able to figure it out. It's kind of like a lot of designers coming to the museum spaces and being like, okay, let's do some interactions, and let's make some points to help people do interactive knowledge and help people learn, but then you get there and it doesn't really make sense. So it was kind of like frustrating that these were the interactions that you saw in the museum, and I wanted to create an interaction that was like more easy to understand and like easier to kind of connect with the knowledge, which is what the point is. It is not about showing the technology, but it's about connecting with knowledge. So then looked at into other like extremes of communication. So how do you communicate through the golden records with civilizations outside Earth, or like how artists have dealt with communicating with the future. And then some other designers. I can go into more detail later, but if you have any questions about particular ones, I can go back to them. But this is a design challenge on signposting radioactive waste site. So the idea was that basically same with the 10,000 years problem, that in 10,000 years we're not gonna have the same language, so how do you tell people not to go in the site? So there were a series of different solutions, and then each of them was rejected for different reasons. So for example, with this one, the idea is that, okay, what if you you had like everything illustrated, because like civilization from the beginning, like you were able to identify symbols and draw, like, draw a human and draw a plant and draw a box, and people would understand what it's referring to. But then what if, well, like what tells you that people read in particular directions? So what if they start from here and they think that someone is dying, and then you find this and then everything is good again? So yeah, like there's different challenges and very, very interesting. There's a podcast about this. I can send you all of the links if you're interested. But yeah, anyways, so moving on. So looking into how objects age and how like there's this tendency for matter to die from the outside, and like entropy taking over on the outsides, and like the objects kind of tending into a pebble shape. And also how different civilizations have been dealing with deciphering of messages and communicating in the future. So then there was a lot of making again, and then slowly the research was disjointed from the making in the beginning, then slowly came together into creating these objects. So finally, I didn't realize how much time it would be on research, sorry guys. But yeah, so these three objects are museum displays, and the idea was mainly to think about how museums, they could be a gravity-activated machine. So looking into the space not as a passive space, but as an active space that gets activated when people walk into the space. So all of these machines, they worked with gravity. So there's a little pedal. So when you walk into the space, you step on that pedal, and then the machine is coming to life. So this is the first machine. A display would be here in the front. I should show more of the context, sorry. But yeah, this is some details of the machines. But let's imagine that there's a little artifact here. And then there's this brush that whenever people walk into the space, the wheel would rotate, and the brush would leave marks on the disc. So the longer people were in the space, the more marks would be on the disc. So in that way, you would capture the story of people being in the museum. Does it make sense? Okay, cool. So yeah, like my kind of worry was that by putting the artifact in the museum display, from one side you were protecting it, but from the other side it was as if you were interrupting this story, this propagation of like the layering of all of those different stories on the surface of the material. And in a funny way, it made me think that the artifacts didn't have a memory of being an artifact, of being in a museum. And like every day they were in a museum space, and people were interacting with them, and people were getting inspired and like learning about them. But then there was no material memory of that. So yeah, this was a response to that, like interacting with that. And then the second one was about thinking about presence in terms of like if there's no one there, then there is no interaction. So like the display was coming to life only when a person was in. So when the person walked into space, the artifact would reveal itself to him as if like welcome him, if that makes sense. And yeah, so like the artifact only existing when the visitor is there. Then the third one was a little bit more complicated, but I also included the conversations that were happening in front of the display as part of the stories. So you have the displayed artifact, and then the pedal and a counterweight and water escape. Now we can go into more detail if you're interested. But then in front of it was a phonograph. So there was a phonograph that was recording on the disc the conversations that were happening in front of the artifact as part of the life of the artifact. And it was this kind of valuing you and all of the knowledge that you're carrying as part of the life of this object. And then we did an exhibition called the Expanded Museum, and it was about this idea of like, okay, it's not just about my artifacts, but it's about how there's like all of these different conversations that are happening today about rethinking all organizations and the museums in particular. So yeah, we did a little exhibition, and we had a lot of people from museums in London take part, and it was really nice. So yeah, that was about material memories. Sorry, it was a little bit longer than I was expecting. I didn't realize how much time it would take me to explain stuff. Sorry if I bored you. So yeah, this hopefully is going to be a little bit faster. So this is in the case of, we're going now in the grounds of Palais de Kyo and Irisine. So with the Irisine sculptures, as I mentioned, they're all like analog, like no engines, no helium, no hydrogen. They just fly with the sun. So just air-filled sculptures that reach up to 16 kilometers high. And then what's interesting for me for that is that in 16,000 meters, there's pressure differences. So basically, if you have a balloon that's on the ground and you take it up to the sky, it's going to expand and then eventually explode. So yeah, I was like, oh, maybe we can do something with that. So started developing some objects that can go on a balloon and then react to that expansion. So you have like expanding structures, and you have some mechanisms that open when the balloon expands. And then we focused it a little bit into origami. So this origami, I don't know if you guys have seen this before. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so basically that, I don't know if everyone heard, but basically this origami, when you move the wings, it's propagating into a change of the beak, so the beak is opening and closing. So if you put that around a balloon, then you could have a mechanism that opens and closes analog without any energy when you go up in the sky. So we created these air filters and air captures. So with Irisine, we wanted to study life in the air, and we want to study things that exist in the sky. So we created these beaks that, when you're in the ground, they're closed, and then you go up, they expand, they open, and they expose the filter. And then they capture, they take the sample, and then you go further up, the balloon explodes, so the thing closes, and then it lands on the ground with a sculpture, and it protects the sample, and you can pick it up and take your sample. So yeah, that's the Arabic. Then we continued with doing further experiments. So with this one, we had different pistons of different volumes, and then we put it on the Irisine sculptures. We put it on a flight and saw how we would react with the different pressure and see how much work it would do. So like how much the different air volumes would expand at different heights. And then we had some workshops. So this was in the Fab City Summit this summer. So we did some workshops where we experimented with all of these material properties and like all of the analog properties and how we could find applications for all of these, which led to Palais de Kyo. So how many people from here have seen the show? Cool. So yeah, for the people that saw it, this was from the first room. You are welcomed with a big galaxy of like a lot of spider webs. For a lot of reasons, I really want to start my speech about the webs, but I'm holding myself. I don't want to bore you more. But yeah, so like in Palais de Kyo, we did a lot of workshops and a lot of observation. So I had the chance to observe how people worked in the space. So unfortunately, there were a lot of phones. So maybe a bit too much. But also there were moments like this and moments like this, and a lot of like people like just slowing down and observing and learning about new things, which was fascinating. Then within this context, I had the pleasure to also exhibit some of the prototypes, and also like one of the prototypes that's somewhere here, hopefully. These prototypes were just like kind of analog mechanical stuff, but it was more about the workshops. So this is the one that's been moving around. It was about the workshops mainly. So about imagining with people all of those applications of analog properties and materials. So there were a lot of good moments and a lot of interactions and drawings and intentional kind of interactions, but also unintentional interactions and unintentional stuff. Like if you give people a pen on a white table, they're gonna write on the white table. Or like with this one. Okay, this is a little parenthesis, but I wanted to show you this. So basically, there was this platform as you walked in. I don't know if the people who went to the exhibition remember this, but it's like when you see the big on air, right in front of it was a black platform on the floor. So this platform was about this height. So this is about the perfect height of the knees of a child. So I would sit on the side waiting for some people to come for a tour. And basically what happened is the parents were holding the kids and they were walking into the space. And then the kids would find the platform, and it was the perfect height for them to walk on the platform. So they walked on the platform and they left a lot of baby footsteps. And then you had a collection of baby footsteps. And then what happened is the adults came and they saw the collection of baby footsteps and wanted to leave their footsteps too. So basically there were these girls that were just walking in. They walked in, they saw that, they just went like bloop. And then continued on to the exhibition. It's just like very interesting to see how, all of these intentional or unintentional interactions happen. It's just like you're putting an object there, which is suggesting something, and then it's kind of accumulating into a series of behaviors. That's really, really interesting. I guess I would, in this point, suggest to everyone to, you know, just stay in the rooms and like put your objects out there and see how people are going to behave and take these unintentional behaviors as part of the design process, and it's going to be really, really interesting. Then going back to the more intentional stuff, there were a lot of drawing workshops and also welcoming a lot of people, amazing people like Pablo Suarez from the Red Cross. He's doing a lot of humanitarian work and talking to people like the White House and people in the UN about like, helping art get outside of the art world and into the conferences and see how creativity and different thought processes can nourish those discussions. And then also we had threads. I guess for the design by data. Okay, some people that took part in the workshop are here, yay. So we also welcomed people that were doing workshops and like some external people coming in and doing some workshops. So you guys focused on taking the data from the sculptures and then turning them into usable material for like designing. So like design by data students might relate. And then we also had a science group that were doing physics of inflatables. So what they did is focusing on how materials shape shift when you input air inside, so when the pressure changes. So this flat object, when you put air inside, it kind of like warped into the shape. And they're kind of testing that and reverse engineering it and see like how you can design and with mind of that. So that was a perfect opportunity for us to design a new workshop around stuff. So we designed the workshop about pressure, and we put a lot of like pistons, and then people were invited to create stuff attached to the pistons, and then we're gonna put them all in the vacuum chamber in ESPCI and see how they shapeshift when they experience pressure. So yeah, this is just to connect it with everything. So this is what we saw here with the beak. It's just replicating the environment that the sculpture would find at 16 kilometers. Just doing that in the lab and see the applications of that. And kind of here, so after that, we see continuing with research and continuing with physics research. Yay! So, I don't have a better way to end, but I guess it's kind of... Thank you.